MechCast, Sunday, November 4th, 2018. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Glad to be back here with you after just a few days. We talked a little bit earlier this week about the new iOS devices and Apple's new iPads and Macs and all kinds of fun stuff. And here I am back with you, as promised, relatively quickly to talk about more stuff, because we really just kind of covered Apple's event. But of course, there's more Apple news and Mac news that's been going on. This time around, we're going to talk a little bit about the iPhone and maybe what Siri sounds like when she's on helium. I can tell you it's not really good. We're going to talk about vintage iPhones. We're going to talk about the new stuff getting put through its paces in terms of benchmarks. We're also going to get deep into Apple's fourth quarter results, which also happened here at the beginning of November. And that's going to round out the news for this week. And then we're going to get into more iPhone XR feedback and stuff. We're going to talk about more of the things that we talked about from the last episode of the MacCast. Lots of thoughts on Apple's announcements and all of the new products that Apple talked about at its last special event. We're going to get into iPads and storage, and we'll round things out with a little tip for those of you who maybe don't want Apple Music. I like Apple Music, but you know, it's not for everyone, and Apple seems to be a little bit forceful about pushing it. So we'll let you know how to deal with that. And that's going to round out this episode of the MacCast. But before we get into things, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is OpsGenie by Atlassian. Now think for a minute about your favorite website or service and what it feels like when that service goes down. Think about the MacCast. I've had incidents where I've had issues with my feed, and I want to know immediately when that happens so that I can correct the issue and respond to it. And that's just my little podcast. Now, I know you're out there. You're in charge of a mission-critical site. You're in charge of a high-volume site. You're on the Dev and Ops team, and this stuff becomes really critical for you. Incidents are inevitable, and it all comes down to how your company is able to respond. Incidents require complex coordination between your operations and software development teams, who are the unsung heroes putting out fires every day. And getting alerts immediately is critical when those incidents occur, and that's where OpsGenie by Atlassian comes in. OpsGenie empowers your dev and ops teams to plan for service disruptions and to stay in control during incidents. It gives you the power to respond quickly and efficiently to unplanned issues. It also helps notify all the right people through a smart combination of scheduling, escalation paths, and takes into account things like time zones and holidays. It also allows for deep flexibility in how, when, and where those alerts are deployed so they get to the right people at the right time. And it's supported by over 200 integrations like Jira, Amazon CloudWatch, Datadog, New Relic, and more. And it also tracks all of that activity and provides useful insights to improve future incident responses. With OpsGenie, your next incident doesn't stand a chance. And if you visit OpsGenie.com, you can sign up for a free company account, absolutely free, no credit card required, and you can add up to 5 team members. That's OpsGenie.com. Never miss a critical alert again with OpsGenie. And a big thank you to OpsGenie and Atlassian for their support of the MacCast. So it turns out, not like you would think, the iPhone may not be so much fun at parties, or the Apple Watch for that matter, at least parties with leaky helium balloons. So an interesting story showed up this week over on iFixit. It was actually a Reddit post that they kind of found and dug into a little bit, because it was an odd story about a hospital near Chicago. What was going on is they were installing a new MRI machine, and suddenly iPhones and Apple Watches, 40 of them actually, began to malfunction or just cease functioning. It was really, really strange. And it was only affecting Apple devices, not Android devices, because the technician installing the MRI machine didn't have his Android device affected at all. And they were going completely dead, wouldn't even power up, even when they were charged. Some of them did come on, but when they did, only Wi-Fi worked, but not cellular data. And at first, the technical person there thought, oh, well, maybe there was some sort of EMP kind of issue, but that would mean other devices and other things would have been affected. And it was only Apple stuff that was getting impacted. And so they started digging into it, and it turned out during the installation, they used liquid helium to actually provide cooling for the MRI machine. That was leaking about 120 liters of it. Now, helium, when it leaks out in liquid form, turns very quickly into gas, and the volume expands exponentially. It goes from 120 liters to 90,000 liters of gaseous helium. And it turned out this was the thing that was causing the problem with iPhones and Apple Watches. And you might be going, why would helium have that kind of effect? Well, this is what iFixit kind of dug into. And it turns out our devices have these things in them called MEMS, microelectromechanical systems. These are microscopic mechanical apparatuses, actually the smallest mechanical apparatuses in the world, and they are used in our devices. Now, very commonly, you will find these things in gyroscopic and motion sensors, but again, this was something that other phones have, so they kind of ruled out MEMS in the gyroscope or the motion sensors. But another place, it turns out, where these MEMS are used is in little tiny timing oscillators. And Apple actually is one of the first companies to use these timing oscillators instead of quartz for the system clock. So a lot of other devices use quartz crystals, which are cheaper. And it's basically to do the timing inside the system clock, basically the heart of your electronics device, or in this case, the heart of the iPhone. And the reason Apple uses MEMS timing oscillators is they're actually smaller and not as susceptible to extreme temperatures where quartz can become less accurate. So Apple switched for a number of reasons. They actually use these MEMS timing oscillators from a company called SiTime. I think it's Silicon Time, SiTime. And it turns out, though, that these little mechanical devices can be susceptible to intrusion, gas intrusion, because they've got a membrane around them. And I believe are either vacuumed or pressurized some way, there's gas in there, and it can be impacted by little molecules that can slip through the membrane. And it turns out helium and hydrogen molecules are small enough to actually get in there. And if they disrupt that, that kills the system clock, which in effect, because it's the heartbeat of your system, kills the entire device. So that's what was going on here. And it was confirmed by Apple's own user guide, which actually states exposing iPhone to environments that have high concentration of industrial chemicals, including near evaporating liquefied gases such as helium, may damage or impair your iPhone's functionality. Now, luckily, most of the time, this effect can be reversed, but it can, as the article points out, take up to a week of your device being totally unconnected from power for that gas to leak out, I guess, and sort of, you know, restabilize. And so it could come back. Now, it turned out in the case of this hospital, a lot of the devices started coming back after a couple of hours. So it was a temporary impact, and it was ultimately reversed in most of the cases. I think there were a couple devices that didn't recover, but it may end up taking more time. But regardless, what a weird thing. And probably not something you're going to need to worry about. I mean, don't stick your, I guess the moral of the story is don't stick your iPhone or your Apple Watch inside a helium balloon. And even there, that might not be a high enough concentration for it to do anything. Although iFixit did try this. They basically surrounded the iPhone with helium. It lasted about 4 minutes before it killed itself and started malfunctioning. Now, again, of course, it'll probably fix itself over time, but you probably don't want to wait a week for that. So let iFixit do the experimentation. You don't need to do it. It is now something you know about. So, you know, just keep your Apple Watch and your iPhones away, I guess, from helium and hydrogen sources, and you should be okay. I don't think that's going to be too difficult for too many of us. You may have heard this term before when referring to older Apple products. At a certain point in the product cycle, Apple takes a product and designates it as either vintage or obsolete. And this week, Apple added a couple of more products to their vintage lineup, including the iPhone 5. Now, an Apple product goes vintage 5 years after the end of production. So once they stop production on that device, 5 years later, it will typically get the vintage designation. And that means that until it goes vintage, Apple has parts and does perform repairs on those devices, either through Apple's own retail stores in the Genius Bar or through Apple authorized service providers. And the iPhone 5 is now vintage in the US. It's actually called obsolete everywhere else. And the reason for that is because the difference between obsolete and vintage mainly exists because of California and Turkey, which they require limited support for certain products for 2 years after they've been marked obsolete. So Apple basically designates them after 5 years, really, after 5 years after the end of production as obsolete, but for certain products in California and Turkey, they actually have to be called vintage because Apple has to continue to support them for another 2 years. And Apple actually has a full list on their website. I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com that lists all of their vintage and obsolete products if you want to take a look at it. And like I said, normally this would mean that the iPhone 5 now would not be getting repair support, or actually would just get limited repair support in California, but everywhere else you wouldn't be able to get service on it through Apple or through an Apple authorized reseller, and Apple doesn't provide replacement parts for it. Now, I say normally because something else happened this week. Apple has a new pilot program for repairs for some vintage products, including the iPhone 5. And that means Apple and Apple authorized service providers are going to continue to provide repairs and get parts, at least while those parts supplies last, for a number of vintage products now. That includes the iPhone 5, as we've already mentioned, but also the MacBook Air mid-2012 models and the iMac mid-2011 models, but only in the US and Turkey. Other countries are not going to be covered for the iMac mid-2011. But it is a pilot program, and Apple is planning on expanding this and adding more vintage models and devices to the program soon. So this kind of plays into what we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast, that Apple seems to be changing direction and recognizing that more and more people are using their Apple products for a lot longer, for longer periods of time, and they're looking at ways to provide more support for a longer period of time for those products. And so hopefully this program is going to go really well, and people will be taking advantage of it, and Apple will see that, you know, people still get a lot of value out of those older Apple products, and there's a reason to keep support going for a lot longer. So it's good to see Apple throwing this program together. It's nice that they've got a few products in there. I hope they expand it out pretty quickly, because I do hear from a lot of people who have older devices and products that they absolutely love, they absolutely continue to use, and they want to be able to get service and repairs for those. And this has been a problem historically, especially for older products. So nice little change going on at Apple, and good to see this program in place. And while we like our vintage and older Apple gear, we also like the new stuff too. And we did get a bunch of new stuff this week, I guess it really is. You know, here we are at the end of the week, depending upon when you hear this podcast, of course. But, Apple released those new iPad Pros. I'm actually I have one of those coming this Wednesday. I'm looking forward to it, a new 11-inch model. So I'll be talking about my first thoughts and impressions as I get to play around with that this week. But we've got new iPad Pros. We have the Mac Mini that a lot of you are excited about. We're going to talk about that a little later in the podcast. And, of course, the new MacBook Air. That means, though, that it's getting out in the hands of reviewers. We're getting early reviews, and impressions are really good right up front. A lot of good things being said about the iPad Pros, the Mac Minis, and the new MacBook Airs. It was a really nice update, and we did talk about that on the last episode of the MacCast. So if you want to hear my sort of impressions about the event, go back and listen to that episode if you haven't yet. But right now, that means we're also starting to get performance scores, Geekbench numbers, performance numbers, seeing how much improved the new devices are. And of course, one of the ones I'm curious about, and you're probably curious about as well, is the iPad Pro. Is it living up to Apple's claims that it's faster than 92% of portable PCs? And PCs, of course, means not only Windows machines, but also Apple's own portables. And it turns out that iPad Pro, it at least in terms of benchmark, just raw processor scores, it's not too shabby. It got a Geekbench single core score of 5,030 and a multi-core score of 17,995. And so what does that mean in terms of perspective? Well, that means it matches the single core score of a 2.6 gigahertz i7 2018 MacBook Pro. Yep, that's the mid-level MacBook Pro. Now, that MacBook Pro does beat out the iPad in the multi-core score, and it has a 6-core processor versus the 8-core processor in the iPad. Now, the iPad processor is really 2 performance cores and 2 efficiency cores, so it's more like a 2-core processor. So it's not too surprising that the MacBook Pro would beat it in the multi-core score, but it actually didn't beat it by too much. And the new iPad Pros are 30% faster in single core and nearly twice as fast in multi-core as the models that they're replacing. So they are high performance iPads. They are kind of screaming machines. And the big deal behind this is that we have those rumors that Apple at some point may design its own processors for Macs and Mac and MacBooks, MacBook Pros. And so this shows good promise for the future of those machines running Apple Silicon. Now, the Mac Mini also is out there, and it seems to be holding its own, especially with the higher price point configuration, with that new 6-core model, the 3.2 gigahertz, 6-core 8th generation Intel i7 processor, the one with the UHD graphics 630, and maxed out with 32 gigabytes of RAM. That's about a $1,700 configuration, so it's not a cheap configuration of the Mac Mini, but that went through its paces on Geekbench and came out with a single-core score of 5512 and a multi-core score of 23516. That actually puts that Mac Mini in line with a 2018 MacBook Pro 2.9 gigahertz in terms of performance, and also, surprisingly, pretty close to the performance of a 2013 Mac Pro. Yeah, it is near the performance of a Mac Pro machine. Now, that Mac Pro, of course, is a 5-year-old machine, and we're going to get new Mac Pros in 2019 that I'm sure are going to blow away anything the Mac Mini can do. But that's pretty impressive performance, folks. And it also outperforms the 2017 iMac models. Again, this is in terms of raw Geekbench scores. We're not talking about real-world performance scenarios and things like that. We're talking about just Geekbench numbers. So, you know, take all this with a grain of salt, but it does kind of serve as a baseline to give you a general idea on how these things are performing. So the Mac Mini is no slouch. And so when you're thinking about the fact that, you know, Apple did significantly increase the base price point, the technology that is in there is sort of proving out that it is, at least to a certain degree, worth the extra money, right? It is a nice upgrade. It is the thing that Mac Mini fans have been waiting for. And again, I've heard from a lot of you already. We'll talk about that here in a minute. And then, not to be left out, that new MacBook Air, it is also performing very well. It seems to be matching the performance closer to the 12-inch MacBook that is already in Apple's lineup. And the 13-inch MacBook Pro still does edge it out a bit in the single-core performance. It blows it away when it comes to multi-core. But again, that's not surprising considering that you've got a 1.6 gigahertz 4-core processor versus a 2.3 gigahertz 4-core processor in the 13-inch MacBook Pro. So, you know, quite a higher clock speed, and Apple is getting a little bit of flack for using the Intel lower power Y series processor in the MacBook Air, but don't let that make you think that that machine is a slouch in terms of performance. It is a very nice bump up from the current generation MacBook Air, right in line with the 12-inch MacBook, a little bit actually better performing than that. And so, again, a really nice upgrade from Apple, and the Geekbench scores, the performance scores, are proving out that Apple has done a pretty nice job with this latest lineup of iPads and Macs. All right, last thing to talk about this week, and we kind of buried the lead because this is kind of the big story of the week. On November 1st, Apple did their fourth quarter 2018 results call. That's their fiscal quarter, and they announced that Apple had their best June quarter ever. It was their fourth quarter with double-digit revenue growth. It was due to strong iPhone sales, services growth, and wearables growth. I say no doubt helped by the sale of the iPhone XS and XS Max, and of course the Apple Watch Series 4 doing a lot to help the wearables growth. Apple noted that revenue increased over 50% in wearables year over year. So, you know, wearables category taking off. That also is the category that contains the AirPods, and we know AirPods have been extremely popular. I think they're one of the best products Apple has put out in several years. And I know there's a lot of you who are AirPod fans out there as well. But let's dig into the numbers a little bit. $62.9 billion in revenue in the fourth quarter. That's up from $52.58 billion in the same quarter last year. So again, significant year-over-year growth there. Apple sold 9.7 million iPads in the quarter. Now, that was actually down from 10.3 million in the quarter a year ago. 46.9 million iPhones, though, slightly up from the 46.7 million they sold last year. Now, that seems bad until you know and hear that globally, smartphone shipments are actually down 6%. So Apple actually able to get a little bit of smartphone growth while their competitors are seeing declines. So not too shabby. And 5.3 million Macs sold in the quarter. That's down just a hair, relatively flat from 5.4 million sold in the same quarter last year. Now, in terms of revenue growth, Apple's other category was the category that saw the biggest gains. It gained 31%, followed by iPhone growth at 29%. Again, this is revenue growth. Services revenue up 17%. And even Macs, despite a tiny drop in unit sales, they actually saw revenue growth of 3%. So that kind of is backing up a little bit Apple's decision to bring up pricing a little bit. As much as we don't like it, it is keeping the bottom line pretty healthy. Now, iPad revenue was down 15% because of the decline in sales, and we hadn't seen new iPads. So that is likely going to shift now that we have new iPad Pros in the market. And still, their market share in tablets went up slightly according to the latest IDC numbers, and that is because their sales are declining, just like iPhone, at a slower rate than the rest of the industry. Apple actually saw a 6% decline in iPad sales, whereas the rest of the tablet industry saw about an 8.6% decline for the quarter. So again, it's not really hard to see why Apple is looking to drive up base pricing on some of their products like iPad and Macs when you start analyzing these numbers, right? Sales are slowing down a bit. We're seeing declines overall in the markets. And so Apple needs to make up for those losses a little bit. You know, people are just upgrading less frequently. That means they're holding on to devices for longer, so that's not necessarily a bad thing. And Apple's going to want to build more value into their products, charge a little bit more upfront, and sort of level that out. And I think overall it's a good thing. And of course, Apple's bottom line is showing it. So for the entire year of 2018, Apple saw $265.6 billion in sales with a net income of $59.5 billion. That's about $11.1 billion more profit this year versus last year. So Apple remaining very, very healthy. A few other highlight points from the quarterly results call. Apple Pay transactions up massively year over year. Apple says they saw triple the number of transactions for Apple Pay this year versus last year. And one thing that's not such great news that they talked about during the call is starting next quarter, Apple is no longer going to be reporting those unit sales volume numbers in any category. Now, they had stopped this a while for the other category, for iPods, right? Other involves now Apple Watch, Beats, headphones, Apple's other accessories, including AirPods, and also their iPods. They're all rolled into that other category. But Apple had continued to release unit numbers for things like iPhones and Macs. We just talked about those unit numbers. They're not going to be doing that anymore. And Wall Street and analysts certainly did not like that because it makes it a little bit harder for them to figure out what's going on with Apple's sales in terms of what they're selling, in terms of how many units of each thing, which parts of the business are maybe healthy, which parts of the business are less healthy. Now, Apple's CFO, Luca Maestri, said that, quote, number of units sold in a quarter is not representative of the underlying state of business. And this is kind of playing back into some of those other things I think that we've been talking about here on the MacCast in terms of, you know, the longer sales cycle, the longer ownership cycle of products, and people maybe not buying as frequently. So the fact that unit sales are in decline, I think Apple wants to counteract because overall they're able to keep income and revenue pretty healthy. So they don't want people focused in anymore on those unit numbers. And they do point out that Apple was one of the last companies to actually report unit numbers on things like smartphones or wearables, or I guess they don't do wearables, but smartphones and iPads and computers. Their competitors don't really report those numbers, so they're kind of trying to justify it and saying, look, our competitors don't do it. We're not going to do it anymore either. So it is going to be a change. It's going to be a bummer not to have those numbers anymore. We're going to see analysts, of course, guessing at those numbers, which they're historically pretty bad at, to be honest. The Mac numbers that were reported recently by IDC and Gartner were lower than what Apple actually reported significantly. So that ends up being a problem as well. And it's probably another reason why Apple doesn't want to give out those numbers anymore. So that's going on. And that was kind of something significant that came out of this quarterly results call. And the other thing is they mentioned the other category that I just mentioned that includes Apple Watch and Beats headphones. They are renaming that category into wearables, home and accessories, I'm guessing to try to account for things like the HomePod, although it's interesting because the iPod Touch is still in there, and of course it doesn't fit wearables, home, or accessories, I guess unless Apple's considering the iPod now an accessory to their other products. I guess you could technically call it that. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. I'd like to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that is Capterra. You know, we've all run into this situation, right? You're at work, your boss comes in, he throws a project on your plate, something he needs you to research or do, and you have no idea where to get started. We're all bound to face those kinds of hurdles, but don't let finding the right software be one of them. With 2019 just around the corner, fast approaching, you don't have the time for unexpected hurdles at work to derail you. Finding software for your business can be fast and easy with Capterra's new free ebook, The Big Book of Free Software, which you can download at capterra.com/maccast. Capterra.com is a really cool site. It's a free resource you can go to find the software you need for your business. And their Big Book of Free Software has helpful information on over 300 different software tools. It's not going to cost you a penny, so you're not going to have to clear it with your boss. And so whether you're looking for new project management software, you're looking for recruiting software, an email marketing solution, Capterra's Big Book of Free Software has something for you. So visit capterra.com/maccast today to get your free copy of the Big Book of Free Software. That's Capterra, CAPTERRA.com/maccast. Go there today, and a big thank you to Capterra for their support of the MacCast. I also want to take a moment and thank LinkedIn for their support. You know, if you've ever been involved in hiring someone at work, you know how critical it is to get the right person. I've been involved in hiring people, and it can be quite a challenge just finding a person who is going to be the right fit. Getting that right hire can have a huge impact on your business, and that's why it's so important that you find the right person. But as you know, finding them, that's the tough part. Where are you going to get that person? Of course, you can post up on the job boards and hope the right person finds you. But if you think about it, how frequently are you hanging out on job boards? I mean, don't leave finding someone great up to chance when you can post your job to a place where people go every day, where they're already hanging out, making connections, trying to grow their career, trying to grow their professional network, and finding job opportunities. That place, of course, is LinkedIn. Most LinkedIn members haven't recently visited the top job boards, but 9 out of 10 members are open to new opportunities. And with 70% of the U.S. workforce already on LinkedIn, posting there is the best way to get your job opportunity in front of more of the right people, people who are qualified for the role and ready for something new. It's the best way to find a new person who is going to help grow your business. That's why a new hire is made every 10 seconds using LinkedIn. Hurry to linkedin.com/maccastjobs and you can get $50 off your first job post. That's linkedin.com/maccastjobs to get $50 off your first job post. linkedin.com/maccastjobs. Terms and conditions may apply. And a big thank you to LinkedIn for their support of the MacCast. Ever since Apple announced the new iPhones, I think I've been pretty vocal about my excitement and support surrounding the iPhone XR. I did upgrade to an iPhone XS, and I think it's an absolutely fabulous phone, but it's a pretty expensive phone, right? It's a higher-end phone, and I kind of feel like the things that Apple has done with the iPhone XR this year have shown that they can deliver a lot of value in a more affordable price point. And you know I am now hesitating from calling it a cheap iPhone or an inexpensive iPhone because it still is very much premium priced. But I do think it's the iPhone that is probably fit for most people out there. I think it's the one I'm going to be recommending to a lot of my friends and family when they ask about which new iPhone to purchase if they are looking to upgrade. Now, that said, we did hear last week from Adam, who tried out an iPhone XR and just found that it didn't quite work for him, mainly in terms of the sizing and the fit. And that is one area where I kind of forget that the iPhone XR, it does fall in that size range that's between an iPhone XS and an iPhone XS Max. So it is a pretty big phone. I'm going to even call it a gigantophone, right? 6.1 inches is not a small display. And I did have a few other folks email me this week after hearing Adam's segment and say, yeah, I got an iPhone XR as an upgrade to my older phone. A lot of people upgrading from, say, like a 6S or a 7, and they're finding that just due to the size, they're not really liking it, saying it doesn't really fit in my pocket, it doesn't fit in my hand, I don't feel like I can use it one-handed comfortably, and they're ending up returning it and going back to their older device, which is a little bit surprising to me. I think I could kind of forgive a little bit of the size for a lot of the performance feature upgrades that the iPhone XR offers. But if it's not the right fit for you and if it's not comfortable, I think the right thing to do is return it. Now, one of you mentioned in your email to me that if you do return it, remember a few things, you know, remove it from Find My iPhone, erase and reset the device, and make sure that you take your SIM back. If you transferred your SIM from your old phone to your new iPhone XR, make sure you pull it back so that you can maintain your number and all of that good stuff. But, you know, as a fellow Gigantophone, I was going to say hater, but I think that's almost too strong a word, someone who doesn't prefer a larger phone, I can understand how moving to a XR might not be the right fit. And also that, you know, to pay the extra premium for a XS, it's a little bit hard to justify just based on size preference alone. And it would be nice if Apple offered a lower price point device in a smaller form factor. Unfortunately, they don't. And that's okay. You know, still a lot of you are loving your iPhone XR. I did hear from many more people who said, I got a XR. I'm absolutely loving it. It's been a great upgrade for me. The size isn't really bothering me. And look, you know, size, that's a very personal thing. We all have to kind of decide what is the right size device for us. And it's great now that we do have a plethora of size options covered with the new technology, with the new A12 processor. Now, the one group that is being left out that I'm also hearing from, and rightfully so, is the iPhone SE fans, the 4-inch iPhones, the small iPhone owners. They're kind of feeling left out at this point, and you're absolutely right. Unfortunately, I think the trend to larger devices has been going on for too long, and the market seems to prefer those devices. And I think small phone owners, you're in a small, minority of users, and that means usually one of two things. Either you're going to get left behind, or Apple typically comes around at some point, as we've seen them do with their computers recently, with the, say, Mac Mini, which hadn't been updated in, you know, how many years. They will eventually come around to those customers and maybe offer up something, but you may have to wait a few generations. Unfortunately, that means sticking with your current iPhone SE models. We'll have to see what happens. My gut instinct says that Apple is not going to do a 4-inch version of a phone with the newer technology, but maybe if enough of you out there speak out and send some feedback to Apple, you know, they do listen to consumers. So if there's a good enough vocal minority, maybe that is something that will happen. Now, the couple complaints, or probably the biggest complaint I'm hearing about the iPhone XR, is the lack of portrait support for things other than people. A lot of people don't know that while it does support with the single lens camera, Apple's portrait mode for studio effects, that does not work. It will detect people, and if it doesn't detect a person in the frame, you get a little message and it says it can't take the photo. That's actually been solved by a couple third-party apps like Halide or ProCamera. So if that's something you're worried about, you can get one of those third-party apps and get that portrait support back. It does make a few people question why Apple doesn't support it natively in their camera app. I'm going to guess that Apple just has a higher standard for the effect. I haven't seen it working in the Halide or ProCameras. I have seen a couple images posted online. I haven't seen it firsthand, but I have seen a couple images posted. I can't really tell the difference between that and maybe a portrait photo that was shot on the iPhone XR or XS rather. But, you know, Apple maybe sees something in there in that separation, and that's why they've chosen not to implement it. It does mean that maybe if they can figure out the software side of things, that they could add it at some point. But until then, you do have access to the third-party apps. The other thing surrounding the XR is I did get a chance to go into the Apple Store and play around with one firsthand. I checked them out this week. And while I don't like the size personally for me, I do have to say I didn't find any personal issues with using the device one-handed. Even with my iPhone XS and my iPhone X, I find that I can't go corner to corner with one hand. I still have to do a little bit of hand juggling, and I did have to do that with the iPhone XR as well. I personally don't have issues with the slipperiness of the phone. A lot of people feel like Apple's current design with the all-glass back is super slippery. I haven't personally had that problem. Now, I do use a leather case, an Apple leather case on my iPhone XS, but even when I don't have the case on it, I don't have that problem. I would imagine if maybe you have more moisture in your hands, you know, maybe I just have drier hands. I don't know what it is, but that doesn't really bother me. Of course, you always do have the reachability option, and I do want to point out that reachability may or may not be enabled by default. You might have to go into settings and turn that on. And also, for owners of who are moving from a phone with a home button, a larger phone, and are used to using reachability, because I have gotten this question from a couple people in the community. They ask, how do you use reachability when you don't have a home button anymore? Because it used to be that you would, I believe, double tap the home button and that would pull down the reachability, if I'm getting that gesture right. It's been a while. But on the new iPhone without the home button, you just simply swipe down on the home indicator, the little bar, the little white bar that appears on the bottom of the phone. Swipe down on that, and that will activate reachability. Again, if it doesn't work for you, make sure you go into the settings and actually turn on reachability. And that can be found in Settings, General, Accessibility. So it is inside the accessibility section. But I have to say, with the iPhone XR, I stand behind my impression that for most folks looking to upgrade from a device older than an iPhone X or maybe an 8 or 8 Plus, this is definitely the phone to consider. I think it absolutely has the best features to price ratio. I think it's the best value phone that Apple is delivering this year. The camera is great. The screen is fabulous. I compared the LCD screen on, you know, the liquid retina screen on the iPhone XR right up next to my iPhone XS, and it seemed to get brighter. Like, the brightness seemed better on that screen than my screen. So in at least one area, it beat it out. I have to admit, you know, the OLED panel does have higher contrast, but it's really almost negligible. I think most people are really not going to be able to tell the difference. Of course, you don't have the 3D touch in there, but that's a feature I don't think a lot of people are going to miss. I think a lot of people don't use that feature. I know there's fans out there, because I've heard from you when I bring this up. A lot of people say, I absolutely love 3D touch. I use it all the time. If you're in that camp, then maybe skip the iPhone XR and go for an iPhone XS or a XS Max. But I think, again, for the broadest range of people, I think you're not going to miss it. I think Apple is moving a lot more to the haptic touch that they're doing now. So the tap and hold for a lot of those gestures. So I think you're not going to be missing out on that too much functionality. The other thing we have to talk about, we already talked about the camera in portrait mode. Because it is the single lens system, portrait mode photos use the wide angle lens. So that is a little bit different, but that's an advantage in one way. It's just a matter of preference, and it just means either you have to move in or out. I have to tell you, with my iPhone XS taking portrait mode, I'm constantly getting the little message that says you need to be further away to get your subject in frame or framed properly. So, you know, you're kind of wrestling with that one way or the other. There, of course, is the lack of a telephoto lens. So if that's really important to you, you know, that is a buying factor. But really, you can sneaker net your sneaker zoom in, right? You can just walk forward a little bit. Maybe not in every case, but in a lot of cases, you can kind of manage that manually. And you're going to save a lot of money by buying an iPhone XR, even if you're not getting that telephoto lens. And I have to tell you, the images, the portrait mode photos looked great. I think it, you know, again, it holds up with the technology. It's the same lens system, the same number of megapixels. It's just a really, really great phone. And it comes in colors, something you can't get with the iPhone XS. Now, one comment I do have on the colors, they are gorgeous. They are beautiful. I think all of them look great. There wasn't a single one that I looked at and said, not so great. You know, it's just color preference at that point. Do you like yellow? Do you like coral? Do you like blue? Whatever it might be. The red, I think, is the best matched in terms of the aluminum band to the color on the back. One thing that might put some people off is the difference between the aluminum band and the color on the back. It's more pronounced on others, that sort of mismatching. The yellow, the edge band looks more gold versus yellow, which it probably looked the least great in my opinion, but I thought they all looked great overall. And depending upon the angle and how you're looking at it, again, I think it's just a great looking phone. And I'd love to hear from more of you who have purchased iPhone XRs. Are you loving them? What do you like about them? What are you not enjoying about them? Continue to send me your feedback, maccast@gmail.com. Now I want to just turn in general to Apple's new products outside the iPhone XR being released, but the stuff that they had at their special event. So I'm talking about the new Macs and the new iPads. I'm hearing from a lot of you who have been waiting on upgrades for new Macs who are super excited about these new models. You've been waiting for these upgrades to come and you're ready to jump. One of the things that really surprised me is the number of folks that we have in our community that have Macs that are really pretty old. Macs that have been in faithful service for 6 years, 8 years, 10 years in some cases. That is almost unheard of in the computer industry. And a lot of you saying, you know, my 10-year-old Mac, it's still running great. It's a little bit long in the tooth, but not any major complaints, but I'm just ready for an upgrade. And these are the upgrades that I want to go to. That Mac Mini, yep, that is calling to me. That is a great upgrade. And so those kinds of, you know, upgrade cycles just further support my theory that, you know, Apple is upping the game in terms of longevity of its products and also upping prices a little bit to compensate for so many of you out there who are just not buying new machines that frequently. And that's not saying that you should. You shouldn't have to. And I think Apple agrees with you. And it just seems to be confirmed by a lot of the comments that I'm getting and hearing from people after throwing out my theory on that. People saying, I love my Apple products because they do last so long and I can keep them for a long time and they continue to perform well. And Apple still delivers software updates for me and I still get the new operating system and the new features. And that is great overall. I think it's a great benefit for us as Apple customers. And I actually find this surprising because there is kind of a big vocal thing going on now in our community on a lot of blogs about Apple's pricing on these new products and pricing going up. There's a lot of negativity being thrown at it, but here in the MacCast community, I heard from a lot of people who aren't really put off by these prices. You know, they are a little bit hard to swallow when it comes to the storage and RAM premiums. Apple, if you compare, you know, what you could get off the shelf to what Apple is charging for the upgrades in their store, it is a premium charge. Now, we do need to step back and remember that in a lot of cases, the components that Apple is buying, even though they're getting them at, you know, volume at a good price, they are buying high-tier, high-quality components. It's not necessarily the same thing that you're running in and getting off the shelf, especially when it comes to things like flash storage. They are getting high-performance PCIe. You know, this is stuff soldered on the board. Flash storage, it's not the same thing that you're getting in, say, an external flash drive or an SSD that you're buying off the shelf. So it is important to remember that. Is the premium that Apple's charging justified because it is super high? We can have an argument about that. I personally think Apple is, you know, charging a little bit more than they should, but they know that they can and it adds to their bottom line. So for all the other reasons, that's why they're doing it. And as long as people are willing to pay, they're going to continue to do that. That's just the facts of life. They are going to push that line right up to the point where people say, nope, that's enough. I'm not doing it. And there definitely are people out there that I've heard from that are saying it. But, you know, let's face it, at this point, I think 256 gigabytes of storage, 16 gigabytes of RAM, those are kind of the minimums for stuff. And really, something that does bother me about this latest update is Apple's kind of base configurations. I don't think are good for most people. I think you're going to have to spend a little bit more money. So when they market and advertise these starting at prices, those really aren't the starting at prices for most people. I think the mid-tier options are usually the starting point where the largest percentage of consumers are going to want to start at. And you're going to pay a little bit of a premium. But if you start to compare it to, you know, what Apple has charged for previous models, it's all kind of falling in line, maybe $100 or $200 more, which is significant. I don't want to minimize that, but I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility or out of the realm of reasonability, especially given a lot of the upgrades that they're building into these systems. Still overall, if you take all the factors together, you know, what's being charged, the quality of product that you're getting, the longevity of that product, you know, I think it's pretty much the way it's always been. I don't think a lot has changed. We're paying the Apple premium that we've always paid and accepted. And, you know, it just continues to be how Apple kind of does things. So like I said, I'm hearing from a lot of potential Mac Mini upgraders, a lot of you very excited to move to the new Mac Minis and not put off by the premium price. You know, I've kind of spec'd things out and I've looked at the Mac Mini versus the iMac and wondered, you know, why would you go with a Mac Mini versus an iMac? But I'm hearing from a lot of people who are saying, you know, I don't want the screen. I want a desktop. I want something that has all the ports like an iMac. And I can configure this one in a way where it's going to give me as good performance, if not better performance than an iMac for around the same price or less. And I can bring in my own screen and stuff like that. So again, a lot of this depends on the configuration. I think you have to get in and play around with things a little bit. And there are some values to be found with the right configuration. And I'm kind of finding personally for me, it feels like doing an upgrade where you start with the 6-core processor and then go with 16 gigabytes of RAM, maybe a 256 or a 512 gigabyte SSD upgrade. And that feels like the right configuration, right point, price point for a lot of people to start with. And it's, you know, it's not cheap. This is an Apple product, but I think it's reasonable for what's being delivered. And then if you need additional storage, if you need more, which a lot of people will, then you add on with externals. Get a USB, you know, C external hard drive, something a little bit more affordable. Put your iPhoto library or your photo library, excuse me, on there, or your iTunes library, your bigger files and storage if you're doing video stuff. Those sorts of things. And I think it's manageable. Remember, this is a desktop. This is not a notebook. So, you know, having a 2.5-inch USB bus-powered drive on there is not going to be that big of a deal in terms of the configuration. And if you want to save a little bit of money, you can upgrade the RAM. So, you know, go with 8 gigabytes of RAM and then get RAM after the fact and install it yourself. You do have that option with the Mac Mini, which is a nice thing. But I'm hearing from a lot of Mac Mini folks, including, I got this comment from listener Chris.
Hey, Adam, this is Chris from the Houston area. I'm a longtime listener. Just want to give some feedback on the Mac announcements. I was really excited, just as you, about the new Mac Mini. I've been waiting for it to replace my 2012 Mini that's been, you know, aging. And the only concern I had was the pricing, as always, of the memory and storage upgrades. I currently got the 2012 with 16 gigs and a quad-core i7 that's been working great. I've been meaning to buy a 1 terabyte SSD, so the Samsung Evo 860, currently as low as $167 for the standard model. I also checked the PCIe model of that, the 870 actually, which is about $270. Well, Apple wants $600 for a 1 terabyte SSD, and unfortunately, as you mentioned in your show, it's sold it in, so not replaceable. At least they made the memory replaceable, because the same thing, 32 gigs of memory from Apple are $600, while you can buy some, you know, third-party memory for less than half of that. So I understand Apple needs to make some profit, but they are buying wholesale, so they are even paying less than what I'm seeing retail. And I don't really think they need to make that much money on this stuff. But I plan on, again, buying probably the 6-core i7, with the 1 terabyte SSD, I guess. I don't have a choice since I got a lot of a large iPhoto library and a music library. And I'm going to be getting probably the minimum memory, the 8 gigs only, and I'll be upgrading those at a later time to 32 gigs. I don't think I need 64 for what I'm doing. So anyway, but I'm excited about that. I also like the new MacBook Air. Also, I still have a 2013 MacBook Pro that works just fine. So I'm going to stick with that since it's not my primary machine. I just like to have my Mac Mini with a terabyte so I can keep all my files local, have all my photos local. I don't like to have everything in the cloud. So I have it local with Time Machine backups and carbon copy clones. So anyway, I'm enjoying your show, and thanks for...
And I'm not sure what happened there, but for some reason that message got cut off. But I think you were finishing up, Chris. And, again, as I mentioned, I think the pricing, it's a premium. I think it's something we just have to recognize that we pay as part of, like people like to call it the Apple tax, but it's just that premium price that we pay. I just wish that Apple didn't kind of have this false... It's almost like a false bottom that I think, if they should have just charged $1,400 for the new Mac Mini and called it what it was and configured it in a way that I think is a good base configuration. Like I said, 16 gigs of RAM and at least a 256 gigabyte SSD, and then let people go up from there. And then it wouldn't be so, I think, as painful. But, I have to say, I would consider... if you want to save the money, I think the best thing to do is maybe go with a little less SSD storage and just buy an external drive or an external SSD that you can add on additional storage at a more, less premium price. And that way you can keep your boot volume and your apps running quickly and fast. But if you just need raw storage for files or documents or other sorts of things, you're not paying that price premium for that storage. So I think is a good way to go, a good option for people to opt into. But I always want to get as much internal storage as I possibly can afford. And I think that's generally good advice. If you can afford it, get the terabyte, get the 2 terabyte, if you're willing to pay for that. I think it's nice to have it built in. But again, that's a nice to have thing. And so if you are on a limited budget, consider some of these other options. I think that's generally good advice, at least when it comes to Apple products. Of course, the alternative is you can go to another platform. If you're really, really unhappy with what Apple is charging and you don't feel that you're getting the value out of it, and this is, again, what we talked about last episode, it's perfectly fine to say, I'm not getting the value, I don't see it there, and I'm going to go a different route. There is nothing wrong with that, and there's no shame in doing that either. And I sometimes feel like, people feel they have to be loyal to Apple. And it's okay to write into Apple and say, hey, I don't think this is right. They have their feedback site, apple.com/feedback, so do that as well. Another thing that sort of came out of this event that I had been thinking about was the fact that I was kind of really wrong with where I thought Apple was going to go with the MacBook Air and the MacBook. If you listen to previous episodes of the MacCast, I really, really felt strongly that Apple was going to sunset the MacBook Air and sort of merge the MacBook and the MacBook Air into a single product line and simply call it MacBook. Well, they did the exact opposite. They flipped the script on me and went with the MacBook Air as the update, and they didn't do anything with the MacBook. Well, I received an email from Tony, and he had an interesting theory about why Apple left the MacBook in the lineup. And this sort of comes into what I was talking about on the last episode of the MacCast 2, where I think Apple has too many 13-inch, 12-inch models in the lineup right now. There is really price confusion. If you're trying to figure out which 13-inch or 12-inch Mac notebook to buy, you have so many options with very, very small small variance in configurations and pricing, and it comes down to really form factor is the only deciding factor. Like, you know, which one do you want? Do you want the wedge-shaped thing? Do you want the super thin thing that comes in, you know, different colors, although the MacBook Air now has its own colors, so it's just like gets all very, very confusing. Well, Tony wrote in to say, you know, I think they left the MacBook in the lineup rather than simplifying the lineup because that's there to fulfill Apple's, quote, vision of the future, which is a Mac with an Apple-based processor, an Apple-designed processor. And Tony seems to think that the MacBook will be the first Apple product with an Apple-designed processor. And I know, I find that interesting and think, yeah, maybe that's a possibility. But just based on the fact that I was sort of wrong about Apple going to the MacBook as the single notebook in the lineup, I'm thinking, because Tim Cook pointed out that MacBook Air owners are very loyal customers to Apple. The people who like the MacBook Air, and I see this in the MacCast community as well, because I hear from these people. People love the MacBook Air. It is probably, and Apple may have commented on this, the best-selling notebook that Apple has, the best-selling form factor. So I'm thinking maybe what happens is the MacBook actually slowly fades out. And again, because we did have a MacBook, and then we had the MacBook Air, and then we had the MacBook. You know, Apple has done this flip-flopping thing. I think maybe they finally realized that the Air is the product that, you know, their customers most love. It's the most beloved Apple notebook, you know, maybe of all time. I don't know. We could maybe argue about that. I personally am partial to the G4 iBook. I think it was one of Apple's best notebooks. But the Air is super, super reliable, super robust, great form factor, has a lot of great things going for it, and now it has the Retina display. So it is an amazing notebook, and I think it is a great option in Apple's lineup, and I'm thinking that's what they're going to go with moving forward, and that will be maybe the first model to get an Apple processor put into it. But really, really good stuff. Just some other comments that I heard from the community. Daniel wrote in, he brought up a point about warranty coverage and cost of ownership. Again, sort of riffing on the thing that I was talking about, saying that I think Apple's increasing prices because people are holding on to their machines longer. And Daniel, you know, thought about that and said, you know, I agree with your assessment about the price increases and Apple expecting consumers to hold on to products for a longer upgrade cycle. But shouldn't that then also mean that maybe Apple needs to warranty, you know, change the default warranty coverage and cover that a little bit longer? Maybe Apple should back up that philosophy with lowering the long-term costs for consumers when it comes to repairs during the useful life of the product. If they're expecting customers to use the product longer, they should warranty it for longer. And if they really do believe that they're delivering bigger value, they should, you know, put basically their money where their mouth is. Maybe stop charging for AppleCare Plus, have it built in as part of the purchase price of the product. You know, if you buy our product at a premium price, if you're willing to pay for the higher quality storage and the higher quality RAM that we say we're putting in there and the higher quality, better components that are going to last longer, then we'll stand behind it. We don't think they're going to break down, so we will put the warranty behind it. And I think that's not an unreasonable request or an unreasonable thing to ask for. Is Apple going to do it? I don't know. In a way, they've kind of done it with the iPhone upgrade program, right? If you're in the upgrade program, AppleCare is automatically rolled in. Now, you're still paying for it. You have to buy it. You're sort of forced to buy it, which is a little bit different than just building it in or having it be part of the price. But, you know, I kind of think that's an interesting idea for Daniel to bring up. I know I would almost argue, though, Daniel, that in a way, Apple sort of already does this. I can tell you from personal experiences over the years, I've had more experiences where I've had something go wrong with an Apple product, even out of warranty, gone in for service, and Apple either just repaired or replaced it, either free of charge or at a reduced cost. It's happened to me more than once, and I hear it from other members of the community. People email me all the time and say, I went in for AppleCare. I went in for service. I was out of my AppleCare warranty, and Apple just took care of it. It's one of the reasons why I'm an Apple customer, is what they say to me, is because they do stand behind their products. They do take care of their customers, and they continue to do that. I know it's not always every time and in every case, but they do offer that. They also have, I think, pretty reasonable out-of-warranty replacement costs, and they also have flat fees on a lot of their repairs, so that costs don't go astronomically high. So I do think they kind of stand behind their products and deliver that value to a certain degree. Could they do more? Should they do more? Yeah, maybe that's a conversation that we can have, and I'd be curious to get your thoughts on it. You know, what do you think about this idea that Daniel brought up? I think it's an interesting one. Not one that I think is in Apple's DNA to go for, but you know, maybe again, if enough of us start talking about it and thinking about it, mentioning it to Apple, might be something that they actually consider. And then finally, you know, the other product out there, the iPad Pro, there seems to be a ton of folks really excited about the iPad Pro. It's getting really, really good reviews. I jumped on the bandwagon. I have an original iPad Pro, first generation, 12.9-inch. I've kind of felt that thing, while it's amazing, it's a device that I absolutely love, it is huge. It is pretty big. And when the 10.5-inch model came out and I saw that, I kind of started to feel that was the perfect size between the 9.7 and the 12.9. And so I got very excited about the 11-inch iPad Pro because now I've got a bigger screen in the same form factor as the 10.5-inch. And because I was a couple generations back, I decided to jump in. I also like the new Apple Pencil and how it connects and all those sorts of things. I'm not so sure how I'm going to feel about the Folio keyboard case and maybe the smaller form factor in the keyboard, but I'm willing to try it out. And so I am downgrading in size a little bit, and I am definitely going to be sharing my thoughts. It's arriving on Wednesday. I can't wait to get it in my hands, play around with it, and let you know what I think about it. But I do have a little bit of buyer's remorse, because if you're reading a lot of the reviews and seeing some of the comments online, a lot of the reviewers are saying the 12.9-inch, because it's now a much smaller form factor, is become the perfect size iPad Pro, especially if you're doing a lot of the things that I'm doing, which is drawing and using it as almost a laptop replacement. So that ratio of screen to actual physical form factor, they're calling that the ideal form factor. So I don't know. Maybe I'm going to regret it and want to upgrade at some point later down the road. But right now, I'm kind of super excited about the 11-inch iPad Pro. And a lot of the rest of you are. Now, not everybody, depending upon your use case, is maybe as excited about it. And I did hear from Tim Chatton this week, and he had these thoughts on the new iPad Pro update.
Hi, Adam. This is Tim of the iPad Pros podcast. I want to send in some feedback about the new iPad Pros and the question you posed about longer upgrade cycles. So my current setup is both second generation iPad Pros, the bigger one and the smaller one, and I use those in my day job and to produce the podcast. What I really love about the second generation iPad Pros is this feature of the smart connector that is enabled through Logitech. They offer a wireless charging stand. So when I walk in the office in the morning, I just yank my smart keyboards off my iPad Pros and set my iPads on these stands. And by the end of the day, the iPads are fully charged, and throughout the day, I'm able to grab the iPad to go into meetings or show coworkers things without needing to worry about plugging my iPad into or out of power. And it is a really clean and awesome setup. And that is something that I will sorely miss by these new smart connectors on these third generation iPads. The placement of this new smart connector is not that conducive to an accessory like this even being made. You would need to actually have two separate stands made, because the placement is different based on the different size now, where it's not on the edge like the old one. So overall, these new iPads look fantastic. But for me, I think the experience would actually be a downgrade on many levels for the work I do. First off, the smart connector change is going to be a big shift for me. I'll need to plug in my iPads for the first time in probably a year and a half. And that's going to be a big downgrade in just overall experience. Secondly, I personally use the headphone jack multiple times a week to capture audio from the iPad to get that onto an external recorder. Dongles and docks would fix this, but I'm not as confident about its reliability. But overall, it's just more of a hassle than my current hardware gives me. And third, I actually own a pretty nice lightning microphone that going forward would not be usable on new iPads, which I understand long-term USB-C is the way to go. But in the immediate, I will really miss this microphone. It's about a $150 microphone that I'm recording this audio right now out of. And fourth, I'm actually a pretty big fan of the gold color for iPads, and I'm really not excited by the fact that I'll have to choose a boring silver or space gray option. As far as upgrading every year or expanding the upgrade cycles, this price is a big deterrent in me even considering the upgrade. By swapping out all the accessories and getting new iPads, maintaining my current setup of two iPads, which I like to do, it'll be a little bit over $3,000 to replicate my current setup with new hardware. I have a 256 and a 512 gigabyte iPad, and that is the capacity I'd want once again. And a note about pricing is the one area where pricing is actually a bit better for those that did buy the whole kit is that the Smart Folio keyboard is actually going to be less expensive, even though the price raise for the keyboard, it'll be less expensive for those that did get the whole kit and caboodle. I really like the Apple leather sleeve, and this Folio basically replaces the need for that. So the $200 price point is actually quite a bit of savings if you were someone that did buy the leather sleeve and the smart keyboard like I did. And I did that for both my big and small iPad Pro. And then one final comment about USB-C is I think this addition of USB-C will really affect the iPad going forward, just long-term thinking about it. Imagine being able to restore your iPhone from your iPad when you have to put your iPhone in the DFU mode to get it back into working condition. You currently need a Mac for that. Imagine a future where you could actually plug it into your iPad for that. Or when Xcode exists, being able to plug an iPhone or a second iPad into the host iPad to develop code for it. There's all sorts of potential with USB-C, and I really hope I was 13 and I was probably 15 tackles a lot of this. And I think the future is great. But overall, I think for a lot of users out there, longer upgrade cycles are going to be a big thing. And in all honesty, the second generation iPad has, I think, a long life ahead of it. The screen technology is, in fact, the same. That ProMotion and True Tone support is in there. And the screen itself, which is what you're working on all day, and the screen you're working on all day is exactly the same as you'll find on the new iPads, just a different frame it's being put in. So for people working out there on the iPad, in many ways, I think the second generation iPad Pro was a bigger upgrade because of the screen enhancements, which is, at the end of the day, what really matters to iPad users. But new form factor looks great. Excited to eventually get it one of these days. Thanks for the awesome show, Adam. Hopefully this feedback is helpful. Keep up the great work.
Hey, Tim. Yeah, the feedback is definitely helpful and definitely welcome. I have to say that in some ways I agree with you. I think that the second generation iPad, definitely, if you have a second generation iPad Pro, there may or may not be a good reason to upgrade to this new generation. It sounds like for you, for a lot of reasons, all the reasons you mentioned, it's not a fit for you. But a lot of your reasons were also very, very specific to your workflows and how you use iPads. And there's also just the fact that you bought the last generation. So any, you know, single generation now upgrade, I don't think for a lot of people is going to be a significant upgrade. We're moving, as we've been talking about, to these longer upgrade cycles. And that means that you're not going to buy a new iPad every year, as much as you maybe want one. And it sounds like you know, if I'm reading a little bit between the lines here, it sounds like you really want one, but you're recognizing you can't really justify the cost or the reason for all the points that you mentioned, right? Because there would be pain points actually in you upgrading and having to change workflows and those sorts of things. And really, from a performance standpoint and also from a screen standpoint, you don't require or need an upgrade. And that's ultimately the point. I think that's a lot of what we're talking about here. The other thing that you sort of closed out with that I want to comment on really quickly is this move to the USB-C connector. I'm totally in agreement with you. I think this opens up a world of possibilities for what Apple might be doing with iPads moving forward, and also moving the iPad more into that production creation sort of device that everybody has wanted the iPad to be. So I do find that very interesting. I had not thought about things like running Xcode and doing, you know, builds of apps on it, but certainly that would be something that could potentially be opened up. And it'll be very, very interesting to see where Apple takes it. So definitely thank you for your feedback, and I'm sure others in the community, you have comments on this topic as well. Shoot us your feedback. Send me some emails, maccast@gmail.com. And while we're on the subject of that USB-C connector in the new iPad Pros, I have received a lot of questions from the community and, you know, questions from folks on what is possible. What is Apple going to do with that USB-C? And I just kind of felt we almost needed a separate conversation about that. So a lot of people, the big question that a lot of people are asking is, does this mean now that we're going to have external storage options available finally for the iPad? Am I going to be able to plug in a USB-C hard drive or a USB-C thumb drive and actually have that mount and access it from the Files app and be able to get things on and off of it? Are they going to be able to connect mice and keyboards? Because Apple has said, you know, they think this is a laptop replacement, that people are buying these instead of laptops or notebooks. So, you know, are we going to get pointing devices? Are we going to get keyboards that we can attach via USB-C? Also, the fact that they seem to be putting more focus on the iPad as a content creation device. Photographers are emailing me. Greg says, you know, he wants this ability to connect drives and devices because you have stuff like quote unquote real Photoshop. Adobe is showing off real Photoshop for the iPad, a full version of Photoshop for the iPad, and photographers want to be able to work with their high-res raw images and access their entire image library. And that's something Greg says I can do with a Surface tablet, but I can't do with an iPad. And until I can do that, then for me, the Surface actually has a bigger advantage. And, you know, we do have the Files app there. So you would think technically it would be possible. It wouldn't be that big of a leap for Apple to make external storage options available or to make external keyboards available. Mice and trackpads, I think that's a bit of a stretch because the touchscreen doesn't require it. You know, you have a different pointing style with a touchscreen device. So that doesn't make as much sense to me. I don't think we want to turn it fully into a laptop, but certainly these other things are possible. I think they would be very interesting. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to say, I don't see it happening. You know, to date, Apple and Adobe's focus seems to be on pushing everything into the cloud. Adobe wants you to put it into their Creative Cloud storage. Apple wants you to put stuff into iCloud, and you would pull it down and access it that way. They don't seem very interested in manipulating and working with local storage, at least when it comes to iOS devices. Now, that being said, is that really reasonable in a day and age when we're getting larger and larger image files? If you want to start talking about doing, you know, video and movie creation on something like an iPad Pro, is that really going to be reasonable? Are they going to be forced at some point to have external storage options? And, I have to say, I think maybe, but really, Apple has always positioned the iPad as not a notebook replacement. And I don't think, you know, just by saying that the processors are getting to a performance standpoint where they're as good as PC processors, I don't think that's the same as Apple saying, we think this is a replacement for a notebook. I think they're saying it's a different thing. It is an alternative maybe to a notebook, but it exists in its own environment as its own thing. And Apple has always had that philosophy around the iPad. And I think they continue to have that philosophy. And I think that extends into some of these other areas, like how input is done, you know, with a keyboard or not with a keyboard or on screen, how storage is done, whether it is in the cloud or connected through some external device. And I think their past decisions and past choices about the iPad will remain. Do I hope that I'm wrong about some of that stuff? Absolutely. But at this point, I'm just not seeing any indications or any sort of hints that Apple is thinking about moving in that direction, as much as many of you in our community seem to want that. But, you know, again, I'd love to be wrong on this stuff, and I'd love to hear from more of you what you think about this. You know, is that really a bad choice for Apple to continue to focus on cloud storage? Is that the future we're moving to, or is it something else? I personally feel like the cloud is going to get faster, accessibility to the cloud is going to get faster, and it probably is the solution moving forward, that you just have this sort of virtual external device that you're always connected to and always have access to. You've got 5G coming down, you know, the pike, and I think, you know, faster and faster connectivity is making this sort of future feasible, and it just becomes more feasible as we move forward. But shoot me some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. The last thing I want to finish up with is a little Apple Music thing. You know, I have been an Apple Music subscriber since day one. The minute Apple made it available, it was the minute I signed up for it, and I absolutely love it. I am a huge Apple Music fan. I use it every day. I love the recommendations. I love the personalized lists. I spend a lot of time telling Apple the kinds of music I like, and it continues to get better and better with its recommendations and playlists. The friends list, you know, finally Apple, in my opinion, has a social media element that seems to work inside of iTunes. And so I follow a lot of people that I know who I appreciate their tastes in music, and that helps sort of shape my Apple Music experience. I have it on my HomePod. It is wonderful in a lot of ways. But I also recognize that not everybody wants Apple Music. Now, Apple seems to think differently in this case, because they are very much hard pressing Apple Music as a feature for customers. And they are doing the hard sell on a lot of people. And there are some people out there that they don't really appreciate that too much. And I heard from Daryl this week, and he mentioned that, you know, I have no interest in Apple Music. So why is Apple constantly bombarding me with wanting to sign up for Apple Music, both in the music app and in iTunes? When I'm going to make purchases, it's constantly asking me to subscribe. Anytime I click on anything, I'm seeing pop-ups, I'm seeing alerts, I'm seeing Apple Music prompt me for that. And I was frankly caught off guard by this, because I didn't know it was happening. I had never experienced it, because I've always been an Apple Music subscriber. So if you're an Apple Music subscriber, you're kind of immune to this. But after getting Daryl's email, I thought, okay, I got to check this out. I grabbed an old iPhone without, you know, created a new Apple ID and tested it out. And he's absolutely right. If you're not an Apple Music subscriber, you go into iTunes, you click on an album, or you're checking out an artist, in a lot of cases, when it shows that album page with the listing, within a second or two, sure enough, a big old ad slides down at the top of the thing saying, hey, you can listen to this on Apple Music right now. All you have to do is subscribe or sign up for a free trial. and it happens over and over again when you go to every page. Now, when I tested this out, I was on a smaller sized iPhone. I think it was an iPhone 5S. I tried it on a larger screen iPhone and my iPhone 10. And there it actually had a closed dialogue. So I think if you tap that closed dialogue, it doesn't, the ad didn't come up again, but it did keep popping up on one of my devices. Also, when you go into the music app, the tabs along the bottom, you have all of the Apple Music tabs, the For You, the Browse, the Radio, the Search. And when you tap on any one of those, For You, for example, it tells you all about Apple Music and asks you to subscribe. When you go to the Search tab, it wants to search inside Apple Music, even though you don't have an Apple Music subscription, because what happens then is you do the search, you tap on the search result, and guess what? It says, hey, do you want to listen to this? Sign up for a free trial of Apple Music. So it is all over the place, and it is really annoying. I was agreeing with Daryl. Luckily, there is a solution where, at least in the case of the music app and iTunes, you can kind of avoid this. You go into the settings, into music, and make sure you disable the Show Apple Music option. Once you've turned that off, your music app will go back to working like it did before Apple had Apple Music. Those tabs along the bottom will change, and you will just have Library, Connect, Radio, and Search. And when you go into the Search option, it will only search your local music library. Within Radio, you can still get Beats 1, the main radio station. But if you do try to go in and listen to any of the pre-recorded Beats 1 stuff, then it will ask you to try and subscribe to Apple Music. But beyond that, if you just disable the Show Apple Music option, it will clean that up. Now, the iTunes will still have the banners on lots of screens. I haven't found a way to actually disable that. But that will at least help out and calm things down a little bit for you, Daryl. And I think this is going to help out other folks who maybe don't want to subscribe to Apple Music. Maybe they're Spotify subscribers or someone else, and they've kind of gotten fed up with the sort of hard sell that Apple is trying to do on Apple Music. I understand where Apple's coming from. They want to get those subscriber numbers up. They want to build up that, you know, that services revenue, and it is working. I will say, if you haven't tried Apple Music, give the free trial a shot. You know, it's 3 months of Apple Music, and I do think it is a fabulous service. And if you enjoy music, I think there is a lot of value in it for you. So that's just my opinion. Again, as always, you can shoot me emails and comments and let me know what you think. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick second and thank a show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications at smilesoftware.com. The podcast is also supported by listeners like you through Patreon. If you'd like to check out our Patreon and become a MacCast supporter, you can get information and details at patreon.com/MacCast. And a big thanks to all of my Patreon supporters. I really appreciate your support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CashFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something that you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-622-4269. MacIM9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/the MacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.